So, how do we understand Agatha? Okay? When you read a story, what are our assumptions about the Agatha? Is it literal? Is it not literal? Is it always literal? Is it always not literal? If it's not literal, then how do you read it? Right? Those are the questions we need to ask. So, the Rambam starts us off in the Hakdamah to Perek Chelek. Right, which is the last parak, or second to last parak, depending on which count, of Sanhedrin. And then he tells us that the world is divided into three types of people with three different approaches to understand Agadata. Okay? What are the three groups? What are the three assumptions people have that he writes about Agadata? So, group one. See outside. Let's see who knows this.
These are the people that think it's stupid.
Nope, that's group two.
No, like, take it literally and believe everything to be true and false.
Very good, right? Group one thinks that all the stories are literal and think that anything Chazal say, Uftov, and think that anything that Chazal say has to be true. So if it's literal and everything Chazal say has to be true, then the stories, in their wildest forms, literally happened. What does the Rambam say about such a group? They're fools. Very good. Let's read that quickly inside. The first group is the largest one. I have watched them, read their books, heard about them. They accept the teaching of the sages in their simple, literal sense and do not think that these teachings contain any hidden meaning at all. They hold these opinions because they do not understand science and are far from having acquired any knowledge. They possess no perfection which would give them their own insights, nor have they found anyone else who would provide them with a similar understanding. Therefore, they believe that the sages intended no more with their deliberate and straightforward utterances than what they understand based on their own inadequate knowledge. They understand the teachings of the sages only in the literal sense, even though some of these teachings, when taken literally, would make even the uneducated, let alone sophisticated scholars, ask how anyone in the world could believe such things are true, let alone edifying. Also, Professor Tversky did an excellent translating it and capturing. The Rambam spoke English, this is how he would talk. Though, from what I've heard, he was the most terrifying person you could ever meet. So, that makes sense. Look. It takes a very special person to be a Hasidic Rebbe, the head of Jewish studies in Harvard, and married into the Soloveitchik family. To do all three of those, it really takes a very unique individual. I remember Luchenstein once telling us that, he wasn't sure whether he should do a PhD or not. He didn't really want to. When he finished college, he was debating between going to Lakewood or staying in YU, and the Rav convinced him that he should go pursue a PhD at Harvard, and he said what tipped it was that the Rav said that if he did, they would learn, Bechavrusa while he was at Harvard because up in Boston, and he said that every morning they had a like chabura. It was him, it was the Rav, Luchenstein, Professor Tversky, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, and sometimes Atara and Tova, right, the Rav's daughters, right. And then he like quickly ran through what they learned in this like 6-hour chavrusa, and I like quickly jotted it down to like try to figure out how much they learned like be'iyun. And like from my very quick calculation trying to catch it was something like 500 blad be'iyun. It while he was getting his PhD, this was a very terrifying thought of this room. So he says, the members of this group, not the group I just talked about, which are very smart people, but back to the Rambam, the members of this group are ignorant, and one can only regret their folly. Their very effort to honor and exalt the sages using their own meager understanding actually humiliates them. Right? He says, you think you're giving kavod to Chazal because you're saying, oh, Chazal said it must be true. No, you are now attributing to Chazal the most crazy things you possibly could have. This is an embarrassment. Okay? Group one. Group two.
Also understand literally, and then look at it and say, oh, look,
Very
Chazal is
good. Group two are the group who says Chazal say things, they meant them literally, but they can't be true, so Chazal are stupid. And he says, what is the Rambam going to say about this group? Also large, even worse than group one. So he says the second group is also large. When the people in this group read or hear words of the sages, they too understand them according to their simple literal sense and believe that the sages intended nothing other than what may be learned from their literal interpretation. Inevitably, they ultimately declare the sages to be fools, hold them in contempt, and slander that which does not deserve to be slandered. They imagine that they are more intelligent than the sages, and that the sages were simpletons who suffered from inferior intelligence. The members of this group are so pretentious and stupid that they can never attain genuine wisdom. Most of those who have stumbled into this error are involved with medicine or astrology. How remote are they from true philosophy compared to real philosophers? They are more stupid than the first group. Many of them are simply fools. Okay, group two. They take it literally, assume Chazal took it literally, and said, and therefore Chazal are stupid. These people are the worst of the worst of the worst. Very good. The third group. Who's the third group? And I remember when I first read this line and I just burst out laughing. The third group, which he starts off, of course I love, its members are so few in number that it's hardly appropriate to call them a group, except in the sense that one speaks of the sun as a group, right? It is not a group. Now, of course, before you get or species, of which it is the only member, which is, of course, where you're like, wait, by not group, you mean you, not you and other people, but you just gave me a group of one. So the third group is you. I got it. Okay. I just remember reading it the first time. I think it was in high school. I just like burst out laughing. I am the only person. The amazing thing, right, is it only gets better when you remember how young he was, right? The Rambam finished Bereshit at like 25. He was like your age when he's writing this. The whole world is stupid. But instead of writing the whole world is stupid, he writes the third group, which is only a group in the sense that you can have a group of one. Okay, well, that's impressive. this group, but then he says, of men, so I don't know who he's talking about. This group consists of men to whom the greatness of the sages is clear. Now, who are they? They're the ones who recognize that. Very good. Now, as we'll see next week, Rav Avraham ben Arambam wrote a perush on Agadata where he notes that obviously the Rambam doesn't mean that every Agadata is not literal. Right? There are Agadata that are literal. The challenge isn't just figuring out how to understand not literal things, and to figure out which things are literal and which ones are not. Obviously, there are many stories in Chazal that there's no reason to not take them basically at face value, or close to it. I mean, maybe a little bit of a literary flourish here and there, but more or less, right? There are plenty of stories in the Gemara, halachic and otherwise, that you would not want to take them not literally, right? Like Rabbi Tarfon said, I once lay down to say Kriyat Shema. Nothing happened, but they say, right? Right, but the sages said, you deserve to die because you went. There's no particular reason to say that didn't happen. I mean, he didn't lie down. Lie down means that he was in a passive rather than active. Like, I don't know what you're like. Right, there's certain stories that it probably happened more or less. I mean, whatever, literary flair here and there. There are plenty of stories in Chazal that happened. Fine. So obviously, he doesn't mean everyone. He means the stories which could lead to the absurd results of group one and group two. So this group consists of men to whom the greatness of the sages is clear. He says, first of all, they know Chazal are amazing. They recognize the superiority of their intelligence from their words, which points to exceedingly profound truths. Even though this third group is few and scattered, their books teach the perfection which is achieved by the authors and the high level of truth which had been attained. The members of this group understand that the sages knew as clearly as we do that difference between the impossibility of the impossible and the existence of that which must exist. They know that the sages did not speak nonsense, and it is clear to them that the words of the sages contain both an obvious and hidden meaning. Thus, whenever the sages spoke of things that seem impossible, they were employing the style of riddle and parable, which is the method of truly great thinkers. For example, the greatest of our wise men, i.e. Shlomo, began his book, which book? Mishlei, with, to understand an analogy and a metaphor, the words of the wise and their riddles. All students of rhetoric know the real concern of a riddle is with its hidden meaning, and not with its obvious meaning. As let me now put forth a riddle to you. Since the words of the sages all, this is from Shimshon, obviously, that line. Since the words of the sages all deal with supernatural matters, which are ultimate, they must be expressed in riddles and analogies. Okay? Now, why would you, right? So we have three possibilities. Chazal meant it literally, and that's how you're supposed to take it. Chazal meant it literally, and therefore you should reject it. Or Chazal didn't mean it literally, and therefore you should accept that they meant something, but not what they said. Right? Or, to put it at this point, when I first gave this year, this was like Trump was still president, so people were still using this. There's probably not, but it's a helpful line. But at some point, some political pundit put it very succinctly, right? That, right, he tends to say some outlandish things, right? So people who didn't like him took him literally, but not seriously. People who liked him took him not, right, seriously, but not literally, right? So group one are people who take him literally and seriously. Second group are people who take him literally and not seriously, right? And then the third group are the people who take him seriously, but not literally, right? That's, I think, a very succinct way of putting this. That should not be taken as an endorsement of any political side, right? It's just a helpful, right? Because obviously there's going to be that one person, you see, I don't know what you would derive from this. I support him. I don't support him. I don't know what to derive from that.
So he was the first person to ever say that this stuff is
literal? No. Not quite. As we'll see in just a second. Yes, I know.
Well, he doesn't, you see, he talks about later how this...
Yeah, no, then he talks about other people. But that first line is just hysterical. Okay. No. Oh, okay, good. So does he write a Peyarshanagarata? Does he write a Peyarshanagarata?
No.
So he doesn't, but he promises you that he is going to over and over and over again. He never does. Right? He always says, I'm going to get to this when I write my Peyarshanagarata. Right? He never does it. Why not? So you would say he died, and that's what I would have guessed. So I would have said that. Either he died, he ran out of time, his brother died. Maybe that's true, but Rav Avram ben Arambam claims that's not why. He says, why didn't my father write it? He was scared. Right? Right? And he says, Vayira Moshe Migeshet El Hahar, quotes the Pasuk. Moshe was too afraid. This is too holy. My father was like, no, I can't do it. I just can't do it. I tried. No, 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 beyond me.
It's written in a metaphor.
Good. So why is it written in a metaphor? Very good. Ezra, why is it written in a metaphor?
There are many reasons.
Oh, good. So you tell me, what are the reasons to write in metaphor?
Well, one of them is that, like, people with less knowledge.
Good. One is to hide the truth from people who can't handle the truth. Okay?
Right.
To quote another movie. Right?
Or can't understand the truth.
Sure.
Right.
Doesn't have the same ring.
Right?
Right? The people who can't handle the truth. Let's stick with that. Okay?
A few good of us will understand it.
Perfect. Perfect. Well played. So one is... Right, because to hide it from people who can't understand, and?
The other thing is that when it gets written in a metaphor, then when someone figures it out, it really has like...
Very good. The other is to force the people who can understand to really work for it, because as the Gemara says, the deepest secrets of Masa Merkava and the like, how do you teach it to students, even the ones who are Ra'ui? You give them Rashi Prakim, you give them the headings, and they have to figure it out for themselves, right? You can't really understand, you can't spoon feed these things. You have to let people come to it themselves. It's a hard process. The Rambam in the Hakdamah to the Mishnah number 2 says about this fourth matter, I mean to say that homily is found in the Talmud. It is not fitting to think its value to be little and its purpose to be lacking. Rather, there is great understanding in it, as it contains amazing riddles and beautiful wonders. As when one observes these homilies with intellectual observation, matters of the true good, about which there is nothing higher, are understood from them. And from them are revealed theological matters and true things that the men of wisdom would keep away and did not want to reveal, and all that the philosophers attained over the generations. And if you glance at it according to its simple meaning, you will esteem matters about which nothing is farther from the intellect than them. And they did this for wondrous ends. One of them is to sharpen the ideas of their students and to draw their hearts, and to blind the eyes of fools who will never illuminate their hearts, right? So the people who can understand, you force them to work for it. And the people who won't understand, so they'll never get it. Baruch Hashem. And if he had shown them the illumination of truth, they would have turned their face away from them according to the shortcomings of their nature, right? If you tried to explain it, they'd turn away. As is stated about them and those similar to them, we do not reveal the secret to them because their intellect is not complete in order to accept the truth with according clarity. And then he quotes the Gemara that I just mentioned. And likewise, some of the sages do not want to reveal the secrets of wisdom to some other sages. And he already mentioned in Chagiga that an honored man of the sages initiated with men who were experts in the wisdom of the story of creation, Masa Breshit, whereas he was an expert in the story of the chariot, Masa Merkava. He said to them, teach me the story of creation, I will teach you the story of the chariot. And they said, the matter is good. And they taught him the story of creation. He abstained from teaching the story of the chariot. And God forbid that he did this because of an evil heart, to prevent them from wisdom or to have an advantage over them, as these traits are ugly in one of the silly ones, all the more so with these honored pious ones. Rather, he did this thing because he saw himself to be fitting to receive that which was with them, and they were not fitting to receive that which was with him. And then he gives a mashal about a mashal, right, from Shlomo, right, that in Shir HaShirim we call the Torah honey and milk, dvash v'chalav tachat l'shoneich, honey and milk under your tongue, and they, peace be upon them, explained and said that the sweet wisdoms that a soul finds pleasant, just like the palate finds honey and milk pleasant, must be hidden, and they should not be spoken about, and they should not be raised to the lips or tongue in any fashion. And that's what it means, under the tongue. But then in the next paragraph he says, but it should be hinted to in writing. Okay? Right? It should be hinted to, and that's why you put it in Mashal. Right? So the compromise to make people work for it and protect it when people can't handle it is that we write in metaphor. Okay? Good. Fine. So now we have those, right? We have the Rambam suggestion that, at least for some Agadot, the way to understand it is metaphorical. And again, avoiding the two extremes, which is it's literal and true, or it's literal and therefore can be rejected, or should be rejected. Okay? However, there are voices, very strong voices in the Masora, that push towards both directions. There are voices in the Masora who seem to say that it is okay to reject Agadata, right, because it doesn't make sense. Now, this is not quite obviously the heretical group who says everything they said is true and stupid and they're all stupid. But there are definitely voices, as we'll just see in a moment, that at least the simple understanding of them is that you don't have to look at every Agadata and say, this is the deepest secrets of the world. You're allowed to say, it doesn't sound right, let's reject it. Okay? And then there are the voices in Chazal, and in amongst the Baalei Masora, who say, our responsibility is to take what Chazal say, literally, and accept it, because they were Chazal. So despite the fact that the Rambam says that one of these groups are fools and the other are heretics, we have other voices in the tradition that approach what the Rambam would call foolish and what the Rambam would call heresy. Okay? So, much of what is found in various writings of the Gaonim tend towards that line of rejection. Okay? So, for example, if you look to the introduction of the Talmud of Rav Shmuel ben Chafni Gaon, he writes, V'hagadah, Kol perush yavo b'talmud al shominyan. Agadata is any non-halachic statement. Shelo yiyeh mitzvah, doesn't have mitzvah, so yiyeh agadah. Ve'ein lecha lomod mimena ela ma sheyaleh al adat. Only learn from it that which is reasonable. V'yesh lecha ledat, and you should know, shekol ma shekimu chazal halacha b'inyan mitzvah, shehimi mipi Moshe Rabbeinu alav ha-shalom. Anything that Chazal gave you that's about a mitzvah, it's tradition from Moshe. Shekimu mikvi ha-gvura, and Moshe got it from God. You can't add to it or subtract from it. But that which they explained in a pasuk, kol echad kifi mashdin is damein lo. Each one explained as it occurred to him. So what do? You learn them. You like them. They make sense to you. Great. They don't. Fine. No problem, right? No problem. Or more strongly, Rav Shreira Gaon, cited by the Eshkol, says, V'amar mar Rav Shreira, Hani mili denafke mipsuke umikre midrash v'agada umdana ninhu. Those things which are just explanations of psukim, they're midrash and agada, they're approximations. V'yesh men shukach, k'gon divrei Yehuda b'inyan v'zot liyuda, shamar sheshimon michal miyuda. He gives you a whole example, right? Skip down three lines. V'chein agadot sh'amru talmidei ha-talmidim. And all these stories in the Gemara that the students tell. Kigon Rabbi Tanchuma, right? Like Midrash Rabbi Tanchuma, right? Midrash Tanchuma, Rabbi Oshia Vizulatam, Rubam Enam Kain. Most of them, whatever, they aren't. Ulakach in Somchen al Divrei Agada, so we don't rely on them. Vanochon Mehem, Mashem Mitchazek, Menasechom, Menakram, Midivrehem, Vein Sof, Vitchila, Tichla Lakada. What do you rely on? Fine, but you don't, they're not binding. Right? You don't have to rely on the words of the Agada. So there are many, many voices in the Gaonim that say variations of this idea. Just 1 second, right? Which is, listen, Chazal, we're saying things. If it makes sense to you, great. If it doesn't, that's also fine. No big deal. People said what they thought. Maybe they were right. Maybe they were wrong. If it's not halachic, it's not from Masorah. So take it or leave it. Now, in certain areas, they're even stronger. So, for example, the Agada thought about medicine, right? They say, no, just reject it entirely. Chazal are not doctors, and therefore they were just telling you what they knew in their time. It's not that it wasn't literal, it's just wrong, right? This is not to their detriment. They're just not doctors, so they recorded what they knew. It's not correct. Don't rely on it, right? But the Gaonim do have a lot of statements where they, and other of them, they're quite strong. They'll say, Ein ze ela hevel pihem. It's just what they said. You know, it's the vapor that comes from their mouth. I still remember when I was in 12th grade, and we were applying to colleges. So I went, they were having a Shabbaton at Penn. So I went for Shabbos to see what it was like. Technically, it was like, it had gotten ridiculous at Rambam and people were going in Shabbatons and missing every Friday. So like, the rule was that if you got, if you went on Friday, to like, because of some Shabbaton, you would get detention. And of course, like I went to Rai Friedman and said, you know, can I go to this Shabbos? And Rai Friedman was like trying to figure out like, what to do, because like I didn't really miss Fridays normally, and like I had a good reason. So Rabbi Friedman was like, I'm torn of what to do, because maybe what I should do is, just to make a point, I should give you detention. It won't really be detention, I won't really punish you, because like not really a reason to punish you, but like to fulfill the rule, you stay in school for an hour, you can do whatever you want, I don't care, but we'll call it you know you have detention. And then he's like, no, I have an idea, you'll go as my shliach, and you'll report back to me and tell me what the community is like. It was like very, very Friedman lumdus there. But anyways, when I was there for Shabbos, they're always troublemakers. So someone was giving a shiur on Agadita and medicine in Chazal and things like that, and how it's not, you know, how, oh, it might be literal. And there was one guy who was clearly like group two of the Rambam, right? And like, he was like looking to make trouble. Right? So he sees me, and like, I look, you know, I mean, younger, but like, I still had payas that sort of wildly went behind my ears, not neatly, right? I look a little bit, you know, if you don't know me, I look a little bit firmer than maybe I, you know, in the from sense. So he like comes over, like trying to pick a fight, and he's like, payas kid, what do you think about this? And I was like, dealing with this. So I was like, well, and then I just quoted him a line of Gaonim of what they said about this. I'm like, well, that's basically what the Gaonim say, here, here, here. And then he's like, I just walked away. I'm like, okay, good. I can now enjoy my Shabbos. I'm going to deal with these people. Give up. Like, it's not worth my time. That was not the most traumatizing part of that Shabbos. It was mostly fun, but there were some very traumatic parts. Just pro tip for life. Try to avoid secular college campuses on Halloween, if you care about halacha at all, and Shmirat Ha'inayim at all. Just, I did not think about that, but walking around at Penn on, which to be fair was not as traumatizing as a few years later when I was scholar in residence at NYU in the village on Halloween. That was, wow, that was like, that was a madriga. Okay, tip for life. Yes.
According to these guys, how is it possible that there are such great minds in terms of halacha, but then they just...
Okay, good. So, I assume that many people think like Ezra, which is really, really, like, the Gaonim are so willing to just say, who cares, right? So, you could have different answers. So, one answer is to say, the Gaonim don't mean what we just said they mean, right? Some people claim the Gaonim mean, yes, I know it's ironic, right? But that the Gaonim really mean what the Rambam means. That when they say take it or leave it, they don't mean take it or leave it, like throw it in the garbage. They mean? Right, if you don't understand it, so don't, right? So you don't have to understand it literally. So there are many who think that that's all the Gaonim are saying. And if you turn just to the last page here, I give you a little bit of summary, right, in number 14. What do the Gonim actually mean? So the Maharal, right, suggests, right, in my outline, that either they're saying the same as Rama or something close to it, right? Or all they're saying is not that you can reject it, but that you can reject its halachic implications.
Right.
Right? Meaning, right, that you read them very, very carefully, and what you mean is, if you're looking for a halachic source, you can't use this, because it doesn't use the same discipline. Okay? However, there are many others who said, no, they really meant it. Now, how could that mean it? So, it could be they don't really mean it at all. Right? So other people said, it means what it says, but they didn't mean it. Because it's possible that it was an anti-Karaite polemic, because the Karaites would try to misuse Agadot, right? So you do see that sometimes the Gaonim bent over backwards to, like, weaken the force of sources that the Karaites use, to the point of saying things that are totally crazy. So, for example, Rav Sajja Gaon says that Yom Tov Sheni is Halacha Moshe Misinai, because the Karaites really fought Yom Tov Sheni. And Rav Hai Gaon says, like, he didn't mean that. Like, he had to say it, because, like, the Karaites were really driving him nuts and wanted to reject it, but obviously he didn't mean that, right? So that does happen. But it could be that, no, like, really, the Gaonim thought that, look, I mean, they were really, really smart people, but whatever, it wasn't Misora, and even really smart people say things that are not always right. And because it's not binding, you know, now, again, it doesn't sound harsh when they just say take it or leave it, yes. And is it as harsh as group two? They're stupid? No, obviously not. But you could just take it much more mildly, which is, listen, smart people say things, but even smart people who say things, it's not always right. And unless you have it right, sometimes the Gemara will say this, right? Im kabbalah hi nikabel. Right? If it's a misora, I'll accept it, right? But if it's not, so yesha lav kasha, right? Then there's, right, I can respond, meaning... What? I understand. But my point is that sometimes I'll say, listen, you know, even smart people get it wrong. If it's a misora, in malasot, I have nothing I can do. But if it's not, so smart people make mistakes also, right? Now, we'll see next week that, you know, there are other suggestions. There are some, actually, I don't think I put it on next week. But there are some Rishonim who say, and these are quite surprising, but there are Rishonim who, like, in the crazy Rabbah Bar Barchana Gemaras in Baba Basra, right, where, you know, he's like riding in waves and he's seeing all, right, all those crazy Gemaras. Some of the Rishonim say, yeah, he fell asleep in the Beis Medrash and he was having, like, hallucinatory daydreams. And, like, he wrote them down. I didn't say it. Rishonim said that. So you could go in a direction like that. I find it weird. I admit I find it weird. Right? And in a Hanami, if you find it too weird, you go in the Maharal and you say, that's not really what they meant. They meant something closer to the Rambam. In a Hanami. But you could say, look, they don't think Chazal are stupid, but they think that Chazal aren't always right. So if it doesn't make sense to you, okay. Right? Meaning, is it such a hate to say that, you know, look, if I did it with the Rishonim and I said, the Chizkuni is very smart, but like, this shot in the Pasuk, lo nirali, mamash lo nirali. Right? Correct, but he doesn't say you throw it all about. He says you get to look at it and say, Masha Kain, Masha Lolo, right? Yes, yes, no, no, meaning you're treating with respect, but you're recognizing everything's right, and it's not binding. So it's stupid. It's not necessarily right, right? Which is different. Okay. The other person who really might say this, but again, this is really unclear that he meant this, and here I actually have reason to believe he doesn't mean it, and that is the Ramban and the Disputation, but I just have to tell it to you. But in the Disputation, so what is the Disputation, the Ramban? His name was? Very good, yes. Right, Pablo Kistriani. Right, so he is an apostate Jew. And what does he do? Right, so he's helping with these anti-Christian, right, these Christian anti-Jewish court cases where they would accuse Jews of heresy, right? or anti-Christian heresy or whatever. So he points to the Gemara that says, quotes the position of Hillel, that the Mashiach already came. Aha, the Mashiach already came, right? And what does the Ramban respond to him? Eini ma'amin ba'agada zu klal. Right? I don't believe it at all. And even if I did, it's a proof to my, and then he goes down to explain it. But he's like, who cares, right? Now, obviously in that context, the fact that throughout the disputation he says things like, you don't have to accept Agarata, you cannot blame him if he was not being completely forthcoming there, and therefore the consensus, I think, amongst both Talmidei Chachamim and scholars, is that you have to take anything that the Ramban says with a grain of salt. Not because the Ramban is not amazing, he is, but because the Ramban was in a very difficult situation there. It's like, we have a lot of these disputations, right? And you have one where, oh, look, Mashiach already came. You have, you know, the one of Yechiel Paris that, oh, look, the Jews, the Gemara says that the Jews actually killed Jesus. You know, you have ones that you do need to sort of, you know, defend yourself a little bit, and whatever you need to say, say it, okay? Right? Fine. Whatever that Gemara means, Ramban has an explanation.
But even then, like,
Yeah. But he's saying, well, you look here, he gives a whole answer. I don't want to get into it, but yes. Okay.
Also,
yeah.
Doesn't he say that now it's too late because he came right?
Yeah. No, of course he says, and it supports my view anyways, right?
He says he's never coming again.
Exactly, because that Gemara says we lost him, and you think that the Mashiach came, but he's coming again. So even the Shitatchem, it's not true. Like I said, this is called a disputation.
Right.
People said a lot of things in disputations that were interesting. Okay? Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So for example, right, the Christians tried to prove that Jesus came from Aleinu, right? From the fact that the Rashi Tevot of not from Aleinu. Aleinu was the anti, but from Breishit Memtet, sorry. From Breishit Memtet, which is, right? Breishit Perek Memtet Pasuk Yud is Lo Yasur Shevet Miyuda Mechokeg Vegrein Golav Aj Ki Yavo Shilo Velo Yikat Amin. Right? The scepter shall not leave Yehuda Aj Ki Yavo Shilo, until Shilo comes, right? So they said, aha, the scepter will not leave Aj Ki Yavo Shilo Velo. What's Yavo Shilo Velo? Rosh Etevot? Yeshu! Aha! Power will leave the Jews when Jesus comes. And the Bali Atosrat who responded to them said, no, you're reading it wrong. If you read the... I need to write this down. It's... Okay, one second. One more time. Lo yasur shevet miyuda. So it's... Lo. They take the lo from the first word. Yasur shevet. So Rashi David is yesh. Lo. No. Yesh. Right? Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda umichokeg mibein raglav mem vav mem lo yesh mum, right? Right, there is a mum, right? Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda umichokeg mibein raglav, right? Ad, so raglav ad is ra, yesh lo mum ra. Oh, right, you already found Yeshu in the pasuk. Lo, no, there is a bed blemish called Jesus, right? So like, you know, is this what you thought Pshat was? Probably not. But when you play the game, you've got to play it well. Right, that's the rule, exactly. It's when you're in the disputation, you can play dirty. That's the rules. Okay? Keep that in mind if you're ever in a on pain of death disputation for the soul of Judaism.
I'll pull out my
yes, exactly. You have to be really good. That the amazing thing about it is that they are so unbelievably good at it. Right? You remember last year when I showed you the Minchat Yehuda, the Baal Yitz, right? The Baal Tzav in Tegematria, who reads into the Pasuk of Ki lo davareku mikem, right? The Torah is not empty. Be Gematria, Gematriot, right? The Gematria of that is Gematria. I'm like, you have to be really dedicated to find that. Right, yes, I know. I got what they did. But they were really good at this stuff. No, but they did it without a computer, which is really impressive, because I can do it in my Bar Ilan. That is not hard. Bar Ilan has a function. You can put in any number, and it will give you every pasuk and every phrase in any pasuk in Tanakh that adds up to the Gematria. So I can come up with the craziest things if I want and prove whatever I want. I won't, because I do not have any interest in that whatsoever. Though there is a discussion of gematria in the book that you suggested to me, and why it's not the gematrias and Torah codes.
I'm not up to you yet.
Well, I finished it. I'm in the next one. But he has a nice discussion of Torah codes and gematrias, and based on statistics and blah blah blah. It's very fun.
I think the Ramban says.
I was not expecting it. I'm like, wow, that's fun. Yes.
I think the Ramban says that only gematrias from Masorah.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways, okay. What about the other extreme? So at the other extreme, you do have a lot of the Chachmei Ashkenaz who lean much stronger towards the Agadata should be taken literally camp. Now, the most radical of them, which you will do later in the year, I assume with Rav Ginsburg, because he always does it, is Rav Moshe Taku. Rav Moshe Taku is just one of those people who... What? Well, Rav Moshe Taku was one of the Balei Tosfot, who is famous for one particular shita of his, which is... Yes, that God is physical, because look, the Agadah say God has a body, the Psukim say God has hands and feet and this and that, and anyone who doesn't believe he has a body is a kofer, because he's denying what it says in the Torah. I remember reading this in a copy of the manuscript. Like, I went down to the Gush Library, and that's what they had on the shelf, is a copy of the manuscript. And I, like, tortured myself and read it.
No, I did not.
I put it bolded in my RJZ. Here, summary. Because you will, because Rav Ginsburg spends, that's what I'm going to spend time on it, because Rav Ginsburg loves spending time on this piece in Rav Moshe Taku. That's a bit extreme, but the truth is that you find much to point to this in the Balei Tosfot. So, if you look at number six, I gave you an article from Rabbi Dr. Moshe Shoshan, who summarizes it as follows. The Ashkenazic approach, Rashi and Balei Tosfot. A very different approach to the relationship between halacha and agadah has been attributed to Rashi in the Balei Tosfot. Now, this is right attributed because they don't have systematic work, so you have to sort of eke it out. The leading rabbinic figures of medieval Ashkenaz, the geographic area roughly equivalent to modern France and Germany. In their commentaries on the Talmud, Rashi and Balei Tosfot do not appear to make any qualitative or methodological distinctions between halachic and agadic passages. They go straight through the Talmudic text, seeking to clarify its meaning and reconcile it with other rabbinic sources. Thus, they seem to recognize the Agadic sections of the Talmud as no less authoritative than the Halachic ones. Indeed, many scholars believe that at least some medieval French authorities, including perhaps Rashi himself, this is very questionable, but definitely true for Moshe Taku, accepted at face value even those Agadot that describe God as having a physical body. The strength of this approach is that it meets the Talmudic text on its own terms. It does not seek to impose an artificial or overly rigid distinction between Halachic and Agadic passages that are right next to each other on a page of Talmud. Nor does it seek to interpret Agadah through the prism of a systematic rational theology that would have been quite foreign to the authors of the Talmud. On the other hand, Rashi and the Balei Tosfot appear to demand that we accept every Agadic statement, at least from the Talmud, as true and normative, just like the halachic statements of the Talmud. This is indeed a tall order. In its most radical formulation, such an approach would demand that we check our rational faculties at the door of the Beit Midrash before endeavoring to study Agadah. All we can do is read the Agadah and accept its simple meaning as the truth, regardless of the challenges that might be raised against it. Now, it is true that it's hard to prove that Rashi and the Balei Tosfot meant this. I mean, sure, Rav Moshe Taku clearly means it, but it's hard because it's more by implication that Rashi just doesn't say anything else, right? He just explains it kipshuto. One second. But give me 2 minutes to prove that it is a plausible read, not just by implication, but let me point to a few proofs. One is the Rosh Mishans. Now, the Rosh Mishans is quoted by the Ramah. The Rosh Mishans is one of the most important of the Balei Tosfot, hands down. Okay? Professor Kanefogel used to say that there are the three most important Balei Tosfot, which he would then always give a baseball mashal, which doesn't mean much to me because I don't know sports very much, and I have heard these names, but the difference between them, not my generation. So he's like, the three most important Balei Tosfot were the Ri, Rabbeinu Tam, and the Rosh Mishans, and they are Babe Ruth, Mickey Mantle, and Luke Eric. I'm like, sure they are. Okay, great. And then he has a whole lumdus about why one's one and what's the other. That's great. Great. Professor Kanefogel is an expert in all things. Okay? Including baseball. I am not. Chata'ai ani maskir hayom. Okay? This is always like when I was talking to Ray Carmi. He's an expert in everything, including, like, he knows every episode of The Simpsons by heart. Right? Okay! I Katonti, okay? I don't know. I can't do it. What? Yes. He also knows every episode of The Police Philosopher by heart with every advertisement, which is impressive because he invented it in his head and still will quote it by episode and season accurately, right? It's consistent. Like, he created a imaginary television show in his head called Police Philosopher that he quotes throughout his classes, right, by episode, right? It exists in his head, and he quotes it. He just pulls that out of the drawer in his head, and then he'll, like, be talking about it and tell us, like, the ads that came up in the episode, right? Yeah, he's very smart. And
I didn't know how to look it up.
What? Because he's consistent. Over years of this, it's consistent. Like, oh, season this, episode this. It's very hard to tell because he'll quote other ones which are like random 1950s black and white British humor things, which actually exist that he also knows by heart. But then he'll also do police. If you look at his Wikipedia page, it's on his Wikipedia page. He also invented in his an imaginary TV show, Police Philosopher. You can ask him. He's wonderful. I love it. Right, Carmi, Sheldon Carmi. But the point of this with the Rosh Mishantz is right up there in the big three. Okay, he is the great organizer of the Bala Yatosvot. He is also the major Bala Yatosvot. The reason people don't know him as well is because what is his greatest contributions? His Perush on Mishnah, and it is the Tosafist material we have in Zoraim Kachem Taro, right? Because he writes on everything, right? Which is very impressive because no one else does. So he's very, very impressive. So when he says something, it's important. He writes, the Eich Yale Aldat Alev Ish. Now, he is the one person who's quite explicit. How could you dare think that Agadah is not literal? You know why I think it's literal? Because of the following Gemara. Im kein, beperek ha-mocher ha-svina, shedarash, well, why don't you look at the story? This is the Gemara that he proves it from. Number 8. The Gemara says in Bava Batra Ayin Hei, ki ha-diyatev Rabbi Yochanan ikadarish. Rabbi Yochanan was learning, atir HaKadosh Baruch Hu lahaviyavan im gedolot umargilot im shloshim ha-shloshim. In the future, God will bring precious stones and pearls that are 30 by 30 amot. V'chokek behen esar al esrim umamidin b'shar Yerushalayim. And he'll hollow them out to 10, into sizes of 10 by 20, right, doors, and he'll put them in the gates of Yerushalayim. Okay? Ligleg alav oto talmid. One student made fun of him. Hashta kibiata ditzitzla lo mishkachinan. Kulehai mishkachinan. He said, what? I can't even find a jewel the size of an egg, and you want one which is 30 amad and 40 amad? Liyam ni mifligo svinata bayam. Then he was going into the river, the ocean. Chaza malach eshar diyatvu vakam minsere avanim tovin margal jim shloshim al shloshim chakuben eser barom esrim. And he was going, he saw angels sawing out exactly such stones. Amr Lahu, and he said to the angels, Hani Laman, who's this for? What's this for? Amr Lay, Sha'atina Kadish Baruch, Lamidim Shari Yerushalayim. These are going to be the gates of Yerushalayim. Atul Kamei, the Rabbi Yochanan. He came back to Rabbi Yochanan. Amr Lay, Drosh, Rebbe, Lechana Lidrosh. Teach more. You should teach and expound. Kashera Marta, Kain Raiti. As you said, so I saw. Now you would say that this story should end nicely. Oh, now you know I'm telling the truth. No, that's not how this works. Amar lo reka, he said, you empty one. Il moli ra'ita lo emanta. What, before you saw it, you didn't believe me? Milagle gal divrei chacham emata, you make fun of the rabbis? Natani na bo v'nasa gal shalat someone. He looked at him and he turned into a pile of bones. Okay, so the Rash looks at this Gemara and says, I don't know. The simple shot here is that Rabbi Yochanan says something wild. The Talmud said, can't be literal, sees that it is literal, and he says, you didn't believe the crazy thing I said before you saw it? And then lasers came out of his eyes, and boom. Right? We talked about last year that obviously we should make a superhero, movie based on Rav Shimon bar Yochai and Rabbi Yochanan. For some reason, all rabbinic powers come down to laser eyes. Unclear, not totally good, but it's almost cartoonish, right? It's like, because clearly, is it just like bones or like, no, like, you know, like in a cartoon, it would be perfect, right? They stare, red eyes, and then like, a caricature of a pile of bones, right? Oh, my Rishon bar Yochai is amazing. Like, right? Where are your powers from? Magic cherubs that came out of the ground. I mean, right? There's a whole origin story. It's great. Okay? What? Oh, yes, exactly. All types of wonderful stories. We could make quite, this is in my list of all the things we have to write one day. Yes, you know, all the mystery novels that I said we have to do, and then this is just another one. Great. So the Rosh Mishans looks at this and says, aha! Look what happened to this guy who didn't take it. And if you think, like the Rambam, that you should take it metaphorically, maybe the guy was laughing because, oh, that's not literal, or he was a koifer, right? He should have come back and said, oh, that's a metaphor. But no, he saw it literally. Now, don't worry, the rationalist Rishonim have a solution, and they say, aha, no, it is a metaphor. The metaphor is that he said something philosophical, the guy didn't understand it, so he said, I don't believe the Mesoira, I'm going to understand it for myself. And then he understood for himself and said, aha, after I jumped into the Yam HaChachma, into the ocean of wisdom, I realized you're right. Rav Yochanan said, what? You didn't accept the Mesoira until you understood it for yourself?
And then he shot
laser eyes. And the laser eye stays, right? Laser eye stays. Now, I don't know how much better that makes it, honestly, because then it's saying that you can't, that you have to accept Mesoira without question. I don't know. But whatever, the rationalists he's shown him do have ways of getting around it. But he uses it as a proof, and he says at the end, he has other ones, right? That the Gemara in Giranasha, Par Giranasha says, V'shloshim mekamot divrecham loshon avai, says there are three times where Chazal talk in exaggeration. From this, he takes that very literally, right? Which is only three times, right? Ma shayich lemnot shloshim mekamot, yamar tikatuva. Now, presumably there's more halacha, whatever. But he says, aha! Three times they used metaphor and were exaggerated, and every other time it's literal. Boom! So that's a pretty strong statement of a very major Baal HaTosfot who says, no, you should take it literally. What about other Baal HaTosfot? Yishlodim. Okay, so I'll give you another example. I mentioned that when I, you know, when I was first learned this, I emailed Professor Kanterfogel and I said, okay, give me an example of, pick a random example from Shas where you think that you can point, you can see relatively clearly, but not as explicitly as the Rosh, that the Baal HaTosfot also believed that Agadata should be literal. So he pointed to number 9 and 10, where the well-known Gemara at the end of Tanit says that what's going to happen at the end of time, all the Tzaldikim will sit around in a circle and point to God and say, Zekei Livan Veyu, right? Now that could be very easily metaphorical, right? What does Tosfot say there? What does Tosfot add? HaKadosh Baruch Hu be'etzba'o. Tosfot adds one word. What is? By pointing, we mean with the finger. So he said, look, it's not explicit, but that's your comment, which is, if it's metaphorical, that is an irrelevant comment. But Tosfot says, by point means, you know, like this, right? That sounds like someone is trying to, you know, well, what does it mean, point? Does it mean with your nose? Does it mean with your toes? Right? No, with your finger! Right? I mean, right, it does sort of sound like it is...
Literally, even literally or metaphorically, what's the purpose of that?
We will get to Agadatar in the year, but... What?
Could you explain it like S-L-O-T-M, like...
You could explain it a million ways.
I'm saying there are ways to explain it metaphorically.
For sure you could. No, of course you could take it... I'm not saying that. The point is that Tosfot, instead of saying what it means metaphorically, clarifies what it means to point. Right? Right? Which is like, you know, that sounds like a little bit of a literal... Now, you could pull the same move on Tosfot. No! He's telling you to understand the metaphor. You have to realize that it's etzba elokim. I don't know. Yeah. You could do that if you wanted. Again, is it explicit? No. Is it explicit in the Rosh Mishans? Yes. Right? The Rosh Mishans is about as explicit as you get. Now, just to give you another one, the Rambam, I won't read this inside, but you've probably heard this before, right? The Rambam says anyone who thinks that God has a body is a heretic. The Ravid responds that you are right, they don't have bodies, but people that are gadol mimenu believed it, but that's not what I care about for now, right? But what does he say? V'lama kara lezamin, v'kama gadolim v'tomi mimenu, halchu b'zeo machshava. You can't call this heresy even if you're right, because many people greater than you said this, but then he adds what? Because they read the Pesukim literally, and because they read Agadata literally, which confuses the mind. Now you learn two things from the Ravid. One is that the Ravid himself agrees with the Rambam, but the other is that he clearly thinks there were people who were Gdolim Vitovim than the Rambam who took Agadata literally. Right? Now, the Ravid thinks it's wrong, but the Ravid is attesting to the fact that there were great people who took Agadata literally, even when it was about God's body, right? So, Again, you don't have to accept it, and the Ravid himself doesn't. But the fact that there were major voices in the Masorah that the Ravid is willing to say, these are great members of the Masorah, and they believe it, right, has to remind you that these, right, these people are in the camp. Okay, so we do have, right, so we have the Rambam who says take it metaphorically. We have the Gaonim who might say that you don't have to take it that seriously, though obviously not heretically and whatever. And then you have certain members of Chachmei Ashkenaz who say, no, don't take it literally. Now, a few more points before we finish. We already dealt with 14 here. I need to make this clear, okay? This is not a rationalist, Kabbalist distinction. I made this point, to, I think it was Ezra before, right? I meant it's you. The majority view of the Masorah, as far as I can tell, is to take Agadatot metaphorically. But that is true both of rationalists and Kabbalists, as much as I don't like using those words. But people that are generally understood to be Kabbalists and generally understood to be rationalists, the difference is not whether you take the Agadatot literally. The difference is what type of meaning, what type of interpretive move you make to explain it. Right? But most Mikubalim, you read the Maharal views himself, and this is, if you look at number 15, I gave you a link to an article, whereby Chaim Eisen makes a very good point that the Maharal seems to view himself as the continuation of the Rambam's project. Right? The Rambam said he was going to write a systematic, metaphorical commentary on Agadah. He never did. The Maharal did. Right? And in that sense, the Maharal views himself as a continuation of the Rambam, except he's a Kabbalist. Right? But that just highlights the fact that the question of whether or not you take Agadata literally or metaphorically is independent of what that metaphor might mean. Right? So you can be a rationalist and you will come up with a meaning that fits in, you know, whatever, right? You could be the Rambam and come up with a Maimonidean interpretation. You can be the Maharal and come up with a Kabbalistic interpretation. Both of them agree methodologically that it's not literal. Both of them methodologically believe that you're looking for some philosophical principle. They happen to disagree on which types of philosophical ideas you're looking for, right? But methodologically, that doesn't change. That's very important, right? Because sometimes people mistake this as, right? And, you know, I think sometimes, like, Ray Slifkin makes this mistake in his oversimplification of rationalists and mystics. I don't like this distinction because, right, there were the mystics viewed themselves as rationalists, and rationalists could be mystical. Mystical just means that you think the goal of your life is unio mystico, which in that formal sense, the Rambam is also a mystic because he thinks that the purpose of life is to become one with God, right? Or your intellect to join with God. So in that sense, he's a mystic, quote unquote, right? It's just a bad translation. There is no good English for what the way we divide things. It's right. These are Christian. These are terms that are based on Christian divisions, right? And the Jewish tradition doesn't really break down this way. But it's just important not to say, oh, you're not rationalist because what?
I mean,
right? Like someone could take it metaphorically and be mystical, when there's be a Kabbalist. It's not okay. That's just a very important point. And then I just gave you in 16. I won't read inside, right? But the Rambam's claim that one day he's going to, you know, get to the book on Agadah. At the end, he says he gave up on them at some point, right? He just didn't write it. So the upshot is we don't have a systematic work by the Rambam. That's what we're going to see next week. The Rav Ramban Rambam does try to pick up where the Rambam left off and highlight that, of course, when the Rambam says you don't have to take Agadata literally, he doesn't mean every Agadata, right? And there are different things that we mean by Agadata. Some are more literal, right? You wouldn't want to say that, like, a pithy aphorism about how you should be a good person is not literal, right? Like, ooh, Pirkei Avot is not halachic, it's agadic, so let me take it all as metaphorical. Let's see. You should have a lave tov. You should have a good heart. No, you shouldn't. Right? I mean, like, you really don't want to go that way, right? Not everything in life should be taken metaphorically, right? So obviously, there's certain agadot that you will take literally, and we need to think more systematically. Okay, what type of agadot do you take literally? What don't you? What, right? Divide agadot more carefully, and then we can apply these a little bit, and then maybe after that, I'm not sure. We go through this debate every year, whether after we do that, we move into actually analyzing Agadata, or we first do whether Some other topics like, can you paskin from a gadata? My tendency is to think that we should probably jump into an agadata. And when we get to a good psachim agadata where it borders on halacha and agada, and the question of psachim is the question, we'll come back to the general principles and analyze it in locally. That's my tendency, because I would like to, before Elul is over, to at least actually study an agadata inside and put this in practice. So I do need to get sort of the categorization done in the Mamar on agada by Rambam and Rambam, but then we can move on from there. We really should close this thing. The air conditioning just